Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we'll explore little-known hidden gems and wild places in Appalachia. We'll travel to Ice Mountain.
Ice Mountain was popular as a place for people to come and make ice cream, at least until the 1920s, maybe into the 1930s.
And find out what rare birds you'll find in Appalachia.
And it's amazing, especially here in West Virginia, in Appalachia, all the different birds you can see just right in your yards.
And we'll take a hike along Pocahontas County's scenic highway to see rare orchids.
When you're here, it's kind of like you've escaped urban and suburban areas. And in a lot of places in West Virginia, it's wild.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On this show, we're going on a road trip along the back roads of Appalachia. We'll discover a rare orchid, a natural icebox, and even get the story behind a bus on a rock. Today, we're launching a new series called Hidden Gems of Appalachia, celebrating the outdoors and the stories behind mysterious and wondrous places throughout the mountains. We'll start with a story about rare wildflowers and a new species of orchid that was discovered here. Chances are, if you've spent any time driving along the backroads of West Virginia, you've driven past a cluster of wild pink or white orchids just off the side of a curvy road. Some of the best opportunities in the country to find these colorful flowers are along our rural mountain hillsides. A few years ago, two orchid enthusiasts found a rare and previously undiscovered species known as Shriver's Purple Frilly Orchid. Roxy Todd traveled with them along the Highland Scenic Highway in Pocahontas County to have a look at one of the mountain state's little-known botanical treasures.
I was sworn to secrecy not to reveal the location of our hike before they agreed to take me to see one of the rare orchids. After all, poachers have been known to dig them up. Let's just say we took a little walk along a road to a steep hillside in the misty mountains of Pocahontas County.
We are in a grassy area between the side of the road and the boreal forest that is common to the highlands of West Virginia.
This is Scott Shriver, a retired high school biology teacher from Pittsburgh, who helped discover the purple frilly orchid and named it after his dad.
He was my dad, and I think he was probably my best friend for 30 years. I really, wanted to honor him, and so I asked if we could name it after him. He died in 2008. We published in 2008, and so it was a kind of a tribute to him.
A report about the new species was published in the North American Native Orchid Journal. But aside from a few orchid fans and scientists, few people heard about the discovery.
You know, as a school teacher, I would tell the kids that I actually participated in the naming of a new species. And so a lot of the kids would say, well, how much money did you get for that? Or, how famous are you? And I'm like, no, there's no money. There's no fame.
The ground is spongy and mossy under our feet as we make our way down a hillside covered in green ferns and tall grass. Scott and his friend Cleet Smith, who helped discover the purple frilly, are on the hunt for the orchid they discovered. Then we spot them. Each of the plants have lots of little purple flowers, each shaped like an orchid with a kind of a funny hat on top and a frilly ornamental skirt at its base.
The group of flowers on that stalk is called a raceme. And sometimes they'll have 40 or 50 flowers crowded very closely together. So each individual flower is no bigger than, say, maybe a nickel or maybe a quarter in some of the bigger ones. But if you get 100 of those all together on one raceme, it makes a pretty impressive display. So a lot of people would be excited to see that, and hopefully they wouldn't pick it, but it would be something that would be attractive to people who are pickers or what have you.
And then they see something they didn't expect to find.
Here's a Lycera.
I'll be darned. Where? I don't see it.
Yeah. You see this one there?
Oh, there it is.
They find a related species, a green orchid, right next to a very rare hybrid version. Basically, they think the green orchid crossed with the purple frilly they discovered, to make a sort of orchid love child that has this cool green and purple color combination.
We found the other parent. So when this orchid, this green one, crosses with one of the purple shriver eyes, boom, that's what you get. And that's a, well, it's a hybrid.
For these two orchid fans, this is like Christmas in July.
It's a treasure hunt. There's no doubt. It's treasure.
Scott and Cleet are part of an informal group of orchid hobbyists who scour the country looking for these wildflowers.
We just fell in love with orchids and we hunted them. I mean, we hunted them from Alaska to Newfoundland. I mean, North American orchids were our hobby. Some people play golf. We did North American orchids. So we were just orchid crazy.
West Virginia has a really good climate and geography for orchids, making it a secret hotbed for finding a lot of different types of flowers. So Cleet and Scott began making regular trips to visit. They even made a goal to see an orchid in every county in the state, and they did.
I mean, I know there's been a lot of cutting of forests, there's been coal mining, there's been a lot of damage that has occurred here, but there's a lot of little nooks and crannies that still exist here that are fairly pristine.
They found that many of the best places to see orchids are in the Monongahela National Forest, 300,000 acres of which are located in Pocahontas County.
And so we were drawn to Pocahontas County because it was like the pinnacle of orchids. You could see 18 or 20 species in one day in bloom.
Orchids even grow in places where you might not think to see them.
And some of the orchids love those pristine niches. Other orchids
love disturbed areas.
Like disturbed areas, like old strip mines is one of our favorite places to go orchiding. Not a strip mine that ended 2 years ago, but one that ended 30 years ago and is recovering by succession. Orchids are going to move into those areas. So West Virginia is just a great place. Pennsylvania's good. West Virginia's probably better. And so we spend a lot of time here.
Neither Scott nor Cleet are professional botanists, but they insist that anyone with an interest in exploring the outdoors can make big discoveries, especially in remote Appalachia.
I think there's stuff in the nooks and crannies of West Virginia that no one's ever seen or described before, and that's exciting. When you're here, it's kind of like you've escaped urban and suburban areas, and in a lot of places in West Virginia, it's just, it's wild.
But this abundantly diverse wildness is fragile. Deer are a threat to orchids, and there are poachers who steal them to grow in greenhouses or to plant in their backyards. Recently, an endangered orchid that grows on Sheep Mountain was nearly wiped out by poachers. So I assure Cleet and Scott, their secret is safe with me. If you want to find an orchid, you'll have to go driving out to the mountains yourself. Keep your eyes peeled, though, because you never know what you'll find on the back roads of West Virginia. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Pocahontas County, West Virginia.
On our website, you can see photos of Roxy's trip to Pocahontas County to see purple frilly orchids. We also have videos and information about some of our favorite places to visit if you want to relax and take in the natural beauty of West Virginia. That's at wvpublic.org. So apparently, Appalachia is home to several rare birds. This next segment, we'll meet a mother who found a creative way to teach her kids about migration, conservation, and even other cultures, all from the same book. Katie Fallon is with the Avian Conservation Center of Appalachia, a nonprofit group that's dedicated to preserving the region's wild birds. She's currently teaching nonfiction writing classes at West Virginia Wesleyan College. She recently released a book called Vulture, The Private Life of an Unloved Bird. West Virginia Public Broadcasting last spoke with Katie in 2011 after she released Cerulean Blues, A Personal Search for a Vanishing Songbird. Today, we're talking with Katie about the book she co-authored called Look, See the Bird. Katie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
In this book, you introduce us to several different children from different states and different countries, as well as different birds and their migratory patterns. What do kids like about this book?
They really like seeing the different kids in the different places all meeting these birds. And one of the cool things about this story is that all the birds live together in the same place during the winter. They all live on a coffee farm in Nicaragua together. And then when it becomes spring, all the birds go to these different places all throughout North America. And then at the end of the book, they all come back to the same farm.
What did your kids teach you about how to present the topics in this book?
My kids really like dialogue. They really like hearing kids talk in books. They like it when I do voices, and they like hearing voices, especially of kids. So I tried to put kids talking to each other in this book, as well as kids talking to their parents or their grandparents. And I think hearing two kids talk to each other kind of lets the kids hearing the story be part of that conversation as well.
When you decided to write this book, did they inspire you to write it?
Yes, definitely. I mean, kids are the future, of course. And if you can get kids interested in birds and nature and ecosystems, and also if you can get them to have some pride in where they live, you know, look at the cool birds that live right around us all the time. They're amazing, and they live here, and they choose to live here. I think that instilling all of that in kids when they're young is very, very important. They'll take that with them as they grow up and become, you know, adults in society.
That's interesting. You know, when I show books to my kids that have West Virginia in it, they just think that's the coolest thing ever.
West Virginia is very important to a lot of migratory birds. I mentioned the cerulean warbler, that West Virginia has more breeding cerulean warblers than any other state. We also have more breeding wood thrush than any other state. And the cerulean warbler and the wood thrush are two interior forest songbirds that are very rapidly declining. So I think putting West Virginia in this book was really important to show that, you know, we have really good birds here. I think West Virginia has the best birds. We just have a very rich bird life here in West Virginia, and I think we could celebrate that a little bit more.
So do you have the book with you?
Let me see.
You got to pour it on now, just like you're, you know, reading to your kids, trying to keep them interested.
Laurel and Cora go for a hike with their mom and dad in Cooper's Rock State Forest in West Virginia. They see oak trees, rhododendron bushes, and mountain laurel, the flower that Laurel was named for. At the end of the trail, they sit on the rocks, eat carrot sticks, and watch the Cheat River far, far below. "Look," Laurel says, "see the bird?" A small hawk flies high above them. The hawk has brown wings and a striped tail. "What is it?" Cora asks their mom. "A broad-winged hawk," Mom answers. "She catches snakes and frogs and mice in her talons, and then she eats them." Laurel and Cora wave as the hawk soars along the mountains. "Good luck catching mice," they call after her.
Was that inspired by an actual trip to the park?
Yes. So Cooper's Rock State Forest is right up the road from us, where we live outside of Morgantown. So we go to Cooper's Rock very, very often, especially in the fall and the summertime. And when you sit at the overlook and watch that Cheat River far below, there are often broad-winged hawks that fly just off the overlook.
Why are those things so important? Why did you want to encourage children to look up and see birds and recognize that that's something they can do?
I think that birds can be a great way to get excited about the outdoors and nature in general. Birds are very important, and they often go overlooked in our everyday lives. You know, birds distribute seeds, they control pests like some insects and rodents, they clean up our carrion, they clean up roadkill. Vultures are very important for doing that. They pollinate. So they're very important to healthy ecosystems. And I think that sometimes in our everyday lives, we forget that we are part of an ecosystem also. We're not just, you know, walking around looking at our phones. We're participating in an ecosystem with everything we do. And I think that birds can help connect us to that.
It seems to touch on some of different cultures as well. I know that we talk about migratory patterns and things like that, but was it also your intention to touch on other things?
Yes. We wanted to show that birds are really the connection between kids from different cultures, kids who speak different languages, kids who might never get to meet each other in real life, you know, are connected through these birds that, you know, navigate through the skies.
Are there any other reasons why you decided to write this book?
The cerulean warbler is the fastest declining songbird in North America, and we have a lot of them here in West Virginia. We have more breeding cerulean warblers than any other state. Ceruleans spend the winters on coffee farms. They use coffee farms in Central America during migration, and then some of them end up spending the winter on coffee farms in Colombia and Venezuela. Unfortunately, since the 70s, a lot of primary forest in the tropics has been cut down to make way for coffee that's grown in the full sun. Coffee grown in the full sun grows faster, so you can turn a profit more quickly, but it also uses a lot of pesticides, fertilizers, and of course the soil is not as healthy when you cut down everything except for one kind of crop. So it's also not good for cerulean warblers and other migratory songbirds and other resident tropical birds who need a place to live. But you can buy shade-grown or bird-friendly coffee instead, which is coffee that's grown in the shade of the forest's canopy. It can be a little difficult to find shade-grown coffee, but it is out there. The Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center certifies coffee as bird-friendly. After I wrote Cerulean Blues, I got connected with a coffee company called Birds and Beans that's based in Boston. And the Birds and Beans company, the man who owns the company is Bill Wilson, who's the co-author of this children's book. And Bill said, I have this idea for a children's book that can show all the birds living on a shade-grown coffee farm and then shows where they all go and what other kids these birds meet. So the book was his idea, but he said, I can't make the words good. So he said, if I give you my idea, can you make this into a story? And then we'll try to find an illustrator.
Katie Fallon with the Avian Conservation Center of Appalachia and co-author of the children's book, Look, See the Bird. Katie, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for talking with me.
In just a bit, we'll hear the next installment of Crystal Snyder's Struggle to Stay story. We'll also hear how one man in Fayette County, West Virginia, found a way to get away from it all by building a small fishing cabin in the middle of the river. That's all coming up in a few minutes. But first, it's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. This week, we travel to Hampshire County, West Virginia, to find out how Ice Mountain got its name. We'll have the answer after the break. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in the Name quest. In West Virginia, there is a small mountain ridge called Ice Mountain. Historical records suggest that years ago, ice could be found here, even in the heat of the summer. Roxy Todd recently visited Ice Mountain to find out if ice could still be spotted and to check out the rare plant species that have existed here since the last ice age.
The hike begins at the base of Ice Mountain. Aside from the occasional car, the town of North River Mills is quiet. An old white house with a wooden porch is draped in the shade of three sugar maples. Across the street is a red barn that was built in the 1700s. I'm already dripping with sweat as I enter the forest and begin the hike.
Well, this little thermometer suggests that it looks like it's about 92-ish, 93-ish.
My guides are Rodney Barchus, who recently retired from the West Virginia Nature Conservancy, and Mike Powell, who now works as the land steward for the nonprofit group.
And we're headed up to Ice Mountain, a nature conservancy preserve The preserve is open to the public, but we do ask that people go on one of our guided hikes.
As we enter the forest, Rodney points to one recent change to Ice Mountain. Small ferns and other native plants are being crowded out by an invasive species called Japanese stilt grass.
The natural world is changing in part because of changes that we are inadvertently making. We're making changes on purpose, and we're also making changes inadvertently, like bringing in the stilt grass from Asia, which is now competing, and you can see it's just formed this thick carpet all over the forest floor.
He says stilt grass is usually spread when visitors hike off the path, accidentally bringing the plant with them on their shoes or clothes. Garlic mustard and even tasty wine berries are also invasive.
I always encourage visitors to Ice Mountain and other places like this to eat as many wine berries as you can.
Mike's job includes organizing a few events each year to help get rid of some of the invasive plants to the forest.
They're just spreading faster than we have the ability to control them.
Which means the weeds are beginning to creep closer to the part of Ice Mountain where most of the rare plants live. Deeper into the forest, the canopy of trees grows thicker. Pine trees and rhododendron crowd the edges of the trail. There's more wildlife, too.
There's a Carolina wren singing that probably likes it because we're down near the creek. There was a few phrases from a wood thrush, a few phrases from a scarlet tanager I heard.
We hike along a creek. Ferns, white pine, and hemlock trees replace the invasive stilt grass we saw earlier. After about 10 minutes, we pass our first ice vent. Actually, I feel it before I see it. Beside my leg, I feel a breath of cool air, like a refrigerator door is open. Then I see dozens of ice vents that vary in size. Some are as small as my hand, others I could stick my head into. It's kind of like a honeycomb with all these little holes in the hillside rocks.
And at those openings, you start to see and feel the airflow. And on a hot day like today, you can really feel a little bit of cool air being exchanged. And as Rodney mentioned, it becomes a lot more evident.
I go closer to one of the vents and put my face beside the cold air. And in a flash of inspiration, I put a can of seltzer water a few feet in to cool down. These ice vents probably formed thousands of years ago, at the end of the most recent ice age. Extreme, repeated temperature fluctuations between seasons likely cracked open the sandstone rocks in this mountain, creating crevices and holes as far as 50 feet. Rodney explains that water there freezes in the winter and is so well insulated that the mountain creates this underground refrigeration effect year-round.
In the winter, water can flow down through those rocks and kind of gets trapped, and when it's cold, it can freeze. In the cooler months, especially in the winter, cold air can also sink into those rocks.
Today, you can't find ice after April or May. But years ago, it never melted, even in the summer.
Popular is a place for people to come and make ice cream, oh, at least until the 1920s, maybe into the 1930s.
As the years go by, Ice Mountain seems to lose its ice earlier and earlier each spring.
We're seeing change here, and what that change is associated with, you know, it could be a couple of different things, but we don't think that we're seeing ice accumulation in here as long as we did in the past.
Geologists haven't decided if climate change is responsible for the declining ice, or if it has something to do with people no longer carving out openings in the ice vents. Whatever the causes might be, the good news is that rare plants that have lived here for thousands of years are still thriving. And for now, the invasive species like garlic mustard and stilt grass haven't moved into this part of the forest. Just a few feet from the largest ice vent are a handful of rare plants that Rodney points out.
This little plant here, some people call it dwarf dogwood, other people call it bunchberry. It is really a dogwood. But it's, again, only 3 or 4 inches tall. It has a beautiful white flower that looks just like the flowering dogwood that blooms in the spring that people are familiar with. So this is one of those northern plants that comes south through the mountains. In West Virginia, where you normally would go to see it, would be someplace like Dolly Sods or Spruce Mountain. But here it is, growing fairly commonly here around these ice vents.
There's also wild rose, partridge berry, oak fern, and a weird-sounding plant called skunk currant.
And if you put your hand down right there, you can feel, as soon as you get the hand down there, you can feel cold air coming up out of the ground where that skunk currant's living.
But the crowning jewel of Ice Mountain is the twin flower.
When it's in bloom, it'll send up a little stalk. It'll have two lovely trumpet-shaped purple flowers that dangle, and it's a very pretty plant.
When plants like twin flowers first appeared in this forest, ancient animals lived in these mountains.
The other things that were living here with the twin flower were caribou and ptarmigan, probably muskox, maybe even things like grizzly bears.
Rodney says he loves visiting places like Ice Mountain to see rare plants that mostly only grow in faraway places like Alaska or Russia or thousands of years ago.
I get to see things that otherwise I would have to be thousands of years away in time or thousands of miles away in distance to see here in West Virginia.
Before we head back, I go to check on my can of seltzer water.
And now she pops a celebratory cold one.
It was in the name of science. Mm-hmm. The temperature inside the ice vent is in the mid-40s. My water tastes amazing. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Hampshire County, West Virginia.
So now you know how Ice Mountain got its name. If you know another story about Ice Mountain or ever heard of another town that you wondered how the heck did they come up with that name, send us a tweet at In Appalachia and we just might explore it inside Appalachia. On today's show, we're launching a new series called Hidden Gems of Appalachia. We want to celebrate the outdoors and some of the little-known stories behind these unique sites and places. If you've listened to the popular podcast Death, Sex, and Money, then you know the reporter in our next story. Back in 2005, Anna Sell was working as a reporter for West Virginia Public Broadcasting. If you've ever driven along US 60 in West Virginia, just past the town of Golly Bridge, you may have looked out your window and seen a home sitting on a rock in the middle of the river. Yep, that's right. To discover the story behind this mystery, Anna Sell and producer Russ Barber traveled by boat to a tiny island in the Kanawha River.
A bus in the middle of a river might be controversial in some communities, but Randy Kice says it's a sacred spot in Golly Bridge.
There's people all over this country stops here, you know, and takes pictures of it. Everybody's wondering how in the world you got it out here, you know, how do you get the thing up on that rock, you know. It's a landmark, you know. It's a landmark.
Rumors swirl in Fayette County about just how the bus landed there. Some say a band of college kids pulled it up on the rocks in the 1960s. Others claim the bus was washed out to the middle of the river during a flood.
Sit back down here, side of it. There you go.
The truth is that it was the work of one man, Bruiser Cole, who was in search of the perfect fishing camp. And as fabled as his camp has become, Cole's given it a simple name.
Bus on a rock.
Cole has lived all of his 81 years in Golly Bridge. His home is in a nearby hollow along Scrabble Creek. But it's his fishing camp that has been his labor of love for 51 years. He claimed the island for himself in 1954 by hoisting a bus up onto a rock outcropping in the middle of the New River. Cole bought the bus and had it barged 9 miles downriver. Then he pulled it up onto the rocks. To hear him tell it, it was an easy process.
I rode it down the river 9 miles. And when I come over here, I had a pair of his boots, and he caught it over there and picked it up for me, tied it. Then I took the old barge up there. It sat over for a month or two. I went up there above the port, that old flat rock. And that's where I loaded this old bus up. I bought this bus off of Otis Morton up there. Okay, this is an old Greyhound bus.
And it also made perfect sense.
Well, I thought I'd make a camp out of it. That's what I got for. Uh-huh.
And then to make a camp, how did you decide to make it with a bus?
Well, it's quick and easy after you get over here. It's already built.
He took the wheels off the bus, rested it on the rocks, and built a foundation around it. He added the front porch using wood from an old C&O depot years later. The reason he likes his camp is simple.
Get away from people.
Why do you want to get away from people?
You know how people are.
The rivers surrounding Golly Bridge provide the perfect buffer for seclusion.
If you ain't got a boat, you can't get across the river. Unless you swim.
He points out that there are no roads except the railroad across the river from town. Everything used to build the fishing camps on his side of the river was boated across. His boat is an oak wood John boat that he made with his own hands.
I just learned to make them just from old everybody around, you know, worked on stuff. A bunch of them made John boats, just didn't make them like these. You have to fit everything on these when you make them. They're good boats.
He and his half-brother Tom build them, a skill passed on by their father. Instead of John boats, some in Golly Bridge call them coal boats.
Oh, it takes 3 or 4 days to paint it and build it and everything.
So you've made boats for yourself and then sometimes you've sold them?
No, I never did sell them. I may help people make some.
To make a living, he did a variety of things. Mined coal, hauled coal, and served as deputy sheriff in Fayette County. He even drove a school bus. Randy Kice rode on Cole's bus as a boy.
I'd go to get on the first day of school, you know. He'd say, "Kice, I got a signed seat for you right here behind me." I know him pretty well. And I'd sit there all year. I'd do it 4 years over there on that hill, and I was right behind him. He'd say, "I want to see your smiling face." The old bruiser, he's something else.
Cole has spent all of his life swimming, fishing, or sitting on the porch watching the river float by. But as with most things, he doesn't wax poetic about the river.
All rivers are just important to communities. See, it's Golly here, and New River forms Kanoa here.
But the history of Golly Bridge is all about the river. Even the name of the town suggests this, linking the name of the river with a human invention. Cole says this goes back to the area's Native American past.
Well, they say all the time the old Indians called New River the River of Death. One thing about the river, you gotta respect it.
Back when our people came to this part of the world, the rivers were the interstate highways.
When the NPR senior correspondent Noah Adams followed the New River North for his book Far Appalachia, it elicited memories of the region's pioneer past.
I tried to think of what it would have been like for my forebears to come there and how much more courageous they were, actually, than any of us could be now. It's just an entirely different existence. Just to go down that river for the first time, going west and not knowing what you would come up against, opportunities and the dangers, you know, it's a pretty intimidating thing.
Like Adam's family, Cole's family came to the mountains looking for a place to call their own.
Let's face it, these are places where our people wanted to come to. The Scots-Irish, my folks, came to Philadelphia and they didn't even stop for lunch. You know, they got off the boat and they said, let's find the mountains. And they wanted to be away from those cities.
Oh, this was all Virginia when my people came in here.
They watched as the Civil War came to Golly Bridge and saw the strategic importance of the river. In 1861, the town's namesake was burned and destroyed as Confederates retreated. Randy Kice knows the story well as a native.
Yeah, it used to be a covered bridge over here, you know, they used to, I don't know if it was the Union or what, you know, used to shoot off this side here and blow it out, you know. About every time they would build it back, they'd blow it out. You know, Gully Bridge is full of history, yeah, really. And people fire cannonballs, you know. There's cannonballs all in the river there.
Now, Coles Camp has become a part of Gully Bridge's history.
1954 when he put it up here. Figure over 50 years old, you know, 50 years on that rock. It's older than me, you know.
From his perch on the porch, Cole has watched the river mark the passage of time. He's seen the town of Gully Bridge change.
Well, it's built up some all along, over a period of years. And they took this highway and everything down to here, the bridge in over here since. It's been incorporated for 20-some years too.
And the river's flow has changed under his watch after the Summersville Dam was completed in 1966.
Well, I've got my hand on the gospel plow, and I wouldn't take nothing for my journey now.
And in the 1980s, Craigsville native Bernard Coffendaffer approached Cole about putting a set of his famous three crosses on a nearby rock.
He come and asked me about it, I told him it didn't belong to me.
Cole helped Coffendaffer pull up a 550-pound steel base for each cross.
I think that this that you see here will last 100 years.
And the camp itself is made from the relics of history.
This is all used to.
And you figured out how to do it all yourself?
Well, I managed.
The seats on the front porch are an old booth from a Kentucky Fried Chicken. A shed from an old Methodist churchyard sits beside the island's outhouse. A satellite dish shields a wood-burning heater from the wind. And when something comes floating down the river, Cole will grab it if it's useful.
Pull it up on the bank and tear it up and use it. That's better than going on down the river. It is usable. That's what's wrong with the stuff now. People throw everything away.
That's not to say the camp doesn't have amenities. Cole strung an electrical line to the bus himself in 1957. Which powers the camp's electric oven and two refrigerators. There's also running water that's pumped right out of the river.
Yeah, all done in the river. Not even cigarette butt. That's what you're drinking. Everything goes in the river. Always on mines and timber stuff, everything goes in the drinking water. That's what you're drinking. Drinking your own filth already.
But some high-ranking officials once claimed that Coles Camp itself was filth. In the mid-1970s, A. James Manchin was on a statewide mission to clean up West Virginia through the REAP program.
REAP comes to Kanawha Falls to rebuke, to rebel, because we are repulsed with these rustic relics of repugnancy.
Manchin set his sights on getting Cole's bus out of the middle of the river, but Cole had another idea.
James, all right, I know it isn't good, but he didn't call no problem. Just thought he was.
Did he want you to get rid of, take the bus off the rock?
No, he didn't say a whole lot about it. Charlie Ken was the mayor over here at the time, and Charlie talked to him. My wife, she called Archmore there, and never heard no more about it.
Whoa!
Danny Kincaid, a friend of Cole's, thinks there's more to the story.
Beer Bruger could tell you a whole lot more about it than I could. He knows a lot, but he won't tell you everything.
In fact, the town legend goes that when Manchin was making noise about the camp, Cole reminded him that he didn't get the nickname Bruiser by going to Sunday school.
Rough when he wants to be. But he'll tell you the truth. Good person. I like to think the world of him.
Cole may be mellowing with age. He stays busy and has plans for a list of improvements to the camp. But he knows he won't be around to care for it forever. He secured a deed for the Rock Island in 2004 and says he has it willed to someone. Kincaid says whoever gets the camp after Cole is gone will be the luckiest person on the river.
It's just the best camp here on the river. By far the best. Good location, good fishing around. See everything.
Like the pioneers before him, Cole struck out to make a home where no one had before. He did it all by the sweat of his own brow and is now reaping the benefits.
How much time do you think you spent working on this place?
A lot.
Has it been worth it?
Oh, I guess.
There's no place like it in the world.
You got that right.
For Outlook, I'm Anna Sale in Golly Bridge.
That story originally aired in 2005 on our West Virginia Public Broadcasting TV show called Outlook. Bruiser Cole passed away in 2012, but his bus on a rock is still standing. You can see video of this story on our website. That's at wvpublic.org. We hope you enjoyed this special episode to kick off our new series, Hidden Gems of Appalachia. Do you have a place you think we should explore? Tell us about your favorite hidden gem. You can send us a tweet at InAppalachia or send us an email to feedback@wvpublic.org. But before we go, we want to hear the next story about 37-year-old Crystal Snyder. It's part of our series called The Struggle to Stay. Last time, we found out that Crystal, a non-traditional student, was in her first semester of college while also working 33 hours a week for a job training program called Refresh Appalachia.
All right, next, we are going to go to Mount West Community and Technical College, and I'm going to go to the tutoring lab and submit an essay that was due last week and start a rough draft for another one. We're going to go there a little bit early before my class starts at 1 and hopefully get that finished.
Last summer was an especially stressful time for Crystal, and by August, things got worse. Roxy Todd reports.
Last year, Crystal's 18-year-old son, Aaron, left home unexpectedly. It began with a heated argument.
We had a little bit of a falling out. I think I was demanding a lot.
Crystal says she was putting pressure on Aaron to improve his grades in school. He was about to start his senior year in high school. She also wanted him to help more around the house. Remember, she's been going to school and working full time, so she's been having a rough time cooking and cleaning at home.
I was wanting him to help and just sort of demanding that he do things around the house and help me with his sister. So he said something really disrespectful. And I told him to leave, and he did. It ripped my heart out because I don't feel like he's at a safe place, and if something happened to him, then I would just like never forgive myself, you know?
Aaron didn't answer her calls, and she didn't hear from him for weeks after he left. She knew he was staying with his dad, her ex-husband, but she was still worried.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what he's doing and, you know, what he's eating and if he's around secondhand smoke, like just all of those things that go through a mother's head.
Then in mid-June, about 9 weeks after they had their falling out, Aaron's stepbrother was killed in a go-kart accident. Aaron came home after that. Crystal recorded this entry at their small home in Ona while she was cooking him a burrito and listening to a Philip Glass CD.
Aaron is taking a nap and came to visit me, so I wanted to feed him. And it's raining.
She steps on the porch for a minute to watch the rain.
Wow, that was lightning and thunder in Ona.
Things got better between Crystal and her son, but she could tell he was having trouble with the death of his stepbrother. He was quiet, and she could tell he was hurting. Also, every time she mentioned school, he changed the subject. She eventually found out that he dropped out of high school.
So he had to do really well this year pass to graduate. And he lost his stepbrother in June, and it was just not, it wasn't possible this year for him to do perfect, get, you know, pass everything to be able to graduate. So, here we are, and that's okay. But I would be lying if I said, I'm not going to say I worry. Worry is not a good thing. I just want a happy life. I want my son to be secure. I want to be secure and stable. I want to do that so I can extend that to them, to my children, to my community. I just want to be self-sustainable, self-reliant. Oh.
Then things got more stressful at work. Remember those squash plants she was planting in July? Well, heavy rains washed away most of the seeds that she'd sown. She recorded this next entry when she was working until dusk to replant.
I just got here in Milton to the farm to reseed some squash that was supposed to have been done last week.
She was halfway through replanting the seeds when she left for vacation. She'd been planning it for a few weeks now. Well, it was kind of a working vacation. Here's something I haven't told you about Crystal. During the last presidential election, she was head over heels for Bernie Sanders. She felt like he was the first politician who understood her struggle.
These politicians are on the side of the greedy corporate billionaires, the 1%. While people like me can't pay their rent and buy food.
For the first time, Crystal had someone to root for as a politician, and it was important for her to attend the Democratic National Convention and volunteer for the Sanders campaign. So in July, she was given 3 days off work on the farm to go to Philadelphia. But once she was in Philadelphia, the people she was getting a ride home with said they planned on staying till Friday, the same day she was supposed to be at work. She didn't call or text her boss, but she did send a message.
I sent an email late Wednesday night, about midnight, Thursday morning. I was due to be back at work Thursday. I said, I'm sorry. I can't make it. I can't make it in the rest of the week.
When she came back, her boss, Ben, asked why she didn't just call or text. Crystal remembers being frustrated with the question, and it turned into a bit of an argument.
You know what? I was in Philadelphia fighting, like, for our democracy, our freedom. They cut me some slack. And that's pretty much what I said, and I think that they're more upset about my attitude about it than even the actual aspect of me emailing instead of calling in. So yesterday they told me that I was beyond like a probationary period.
Her bosses said if she was late or didn't show up for work again, then she would be terminated. The threat of losing her job, combined with the trouble she was having with her son, her intense disappointment that Bernie Sanders lost the primaries, and the pressure of having to replant the entire squash field in the midst of everything else, it was too much stress.
I'm not sleeping, and I'm having, like, chest pain, and just so much pressure. I feel so alone.
She tried to call her sister, her only family member she's close to, but she couldn't get a hold of her.
It would just be really nice if there were, like, a mother or a father, or a grandparent, or an aunt or uncle or someone that I could just, like, I could just hug and, like, they would just tell me it's gonna be okay. But there's not.
It's like I'm the one that has to lift everybody else up, and like I like doing that for people, but sometimes I just need somebody to be that person for me.
The next morning, Crystal had to go to a special meeting with her bosses and talk about what would happen next. We'll hear more about that next time. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Cabell County, West Virginia.
Tune in next week to hear the next part of Crystal Snyder's Struggle to Stay. Well, that's our show to launch our new series, Hidden Gems of Appalachia. I suppose, living here my whole life, I never really paid much attention to what might be considered wondrous in these mountains. A few years ago, I wanted to share with my kids what makes West Virginia so special to me, and it was hard to find the words. So I started revisiting childhood trails on occasion while looking for new things that might interest them. And even in a time of disheartening news and financial struggles, I'll still look for those gems in Appalachia so the next generation can see how special this place really is. Till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Kaya Cater, Marisa Anderson, and Ben Townsend. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Inside Appalachia is produced by Roxy Todd and myself. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Claire Hemme helped with our digital correspondence. Glennis Board edited our show this week. And again, you can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia, and you can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, at wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.